Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
BBC Six. Never Early.
Never to come back. Go turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to a special edition of The First Time, where we meet some of our most influential musicians and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. And today's guest is the drummer with the greatest rock and roll band of all time. From the Rolling Stones, it's Charlie Watts. Mick Jagger's ego might always occupy the centre stage, and Keith Richards is the archetypal elegantly wasted rocker, but Charlie is without doubt the heart of the Stones. His distinctive and deceptively powerful drumming has propelled the group through their 50-year career and countless classic hits. Stones members may come and go, but as Keith himself admits, no Charlie, no Stones. Here in this rare interview, and in his famous deadpan and laconic style, Charlie discusses his pre-Stones career, the early starving bedsit days of what would become one of the biggest bands in the world, and the roots of his overriding musical passion, which is jazz. He also sheds a light on his role within the complex relationships within the group, their golden years of recording, and his own brief but hard-fought battle with drugs, and of course, whether the Stones would or even could ever tour again. And I start by asking Charlie, as I do with all my guests on the show, when was the first time he was aware of music?
Parties at my grandparents' house. There's quite a lot of us in our family. Not my immediate family, but by the time uncles, aunts and everybody got together, there's quite a lot of us. And we would all be in what they called the front room in those days and playing Johnny Ray and Four Aces and things like that.
Three coins in the fountain, each one seeking happiness. Thrown by three hopeful lovers,
Which one will the fountain bless?
Quite a musical family then.
No. No, they just we just had lots of in those days, 78, and I remember when my uncle first bought a 45 RPM, you know, which was a single. In those days, they used to do singles, and it was some dreadful record. Gordon McRae, it was some song he sang, but it was awful. But the songs I remember were like Johnny Ray's, and Billy Eckstein was a great, wonderful singer as well as a big thing of my father. So I was brought up on Billy Eckstein, and you know.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart.
What was the first record that you owned that was yours?
The first record I remember that I fell in love with, apart from Billy Eckstein and Johnny Ray type things, was a thing called Flamingo by a saxophone player called Earl Bostic, and that was my uncle's. And soon after that, I bought a record called Walking Shoes by Jerry Mulligan's Quartet, and that was the first. Earl Bostic was a sort of R&B jazz player, and Jerry Mulligan was out and out jazz thing.
Were you drawn to it straight away?
I don't know why, but I was. Soon after that, I heard Charlie Parker, and I loved Charlie Parker, and I still do. And I listen to the same records I played then as I do now. They have the same emotions for me and everything.
I was going to ask how this kind of jazz big band obsessive ended up playing blues then.
So the bass player was my next door neighbour. We're the same age virtually. We grew up together from the age of four and listened to all this music, and he went in a jazz direction to Ronnie Scott's. We used to play in jazz groups together, and I just got asked to play in blues band. Alexis Corner. I played in a jazz quartet at a place called the Troubadour, which is still there, Coffee by an Earl's Court. We used to have a sort of we thought we were Thelonious Monk's quartet. One night, Alexis came in and sat in, and Ginger Baker used to come down there. 6 months or so later, I got a message from Alexis to say, would I go and play in this band of his? And I went there, and my wife was there. So that's where I met my wife. At the rehearsal of Alexis' band, and I wondered what the hell they were playing. And for some reason, Alexis asked me to join the band, and I did for a year or so. Because of Alexis, I got asked to play in lots of blues bands, so I became associated with blues. While I was with Alexis, all his life was a hub for young people, and particularly blues and obscure jazz players. He was a great one for bringing them on and listening to them. And one of these people was Brian Jones in the early days. So I played with Brian and knew him socially through Alexis.
A gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, I got a boy child coming, gonna be a son of a gun, gonna make you pretty women all jump and shout, the world gonna know. I got the John the Conqueror. I'm gonna mess with you, make it pretty girls lead me by my hand, the world gonna know. Seventh hour, on the seventh day, on the seventh month, seven doctors say I was born for good luck, and that you'll see, got $700, don't you mess with.
And then Mick sang with Alexis a few times, and Keith sat in with Alexis a couple of times. So I knew them as people and playing with them. I left Alexis and started playing with various blues bands. And then I was asked to join the Rolling Stones. It was another band to join. I was in about three of them. No work, but I was asked to play in three bands. But once I joined the Rolling Stones, as we were called that then, I went to live with them, and that's when I formed an impression of them, because I used to stay in London instead of going all the way back home. I used to hang out, and we'd rehearse a lot, and Brian and Keith never went to work, so we'd play records all day, and that rather bohemian life. Mick was at university. He paid the rent.
Everything's wrong since me and my baby parted. All day long I'm walking cause I couldn't get my car started. Later from my job and I came for to check it. I wish somebody come along and run into it and wreck it. Come on, since me and my baby parted. Come on, I can't get started. Come on, I can't afford to check it. I wish somebody come along and run into it and wreck it. Everything is wrong since I've been without you. Every night I live with thinking about you. Every time the phone rings, it sounds like thunder. Some stupid guy trying to reach another number. Come on, since I've been without you. Come on, always thinking about you. Come on, phone sounds like thunder. Some stupid guy trying to reach another number. Baby, I really want to see you, and I don't mean maybe. I'm doing everything trying to make you see that I belong to you, honey, you belong to me. Come on, I want to see you, baby. Come on, I don't mean maybe. Come on, I'm trying to
gonna make you see that I belong to you and you belong to me. And come on, I gotta see you, baby, come on. I don't mean maybe, come on. I gotta make you see that I belong to you and you belong to me. And come on, come on, come on.
What can you remember from doing that first Stone single, Come On?
What do I remember? It was an obscure song that Chuck Berry made. I got no idea why we chose that one, because we did lots of others much better, but it wasn't well known, so, you know.
How did you deal with the... Because you got very famous very quickly.
We were very lucky in that we never really had a downside as far as audience went. Brian, in the early days, used to work really hard. I mean, the days before we had any work, very hard, sending letters and promoting R&B, as we called it, and the Rolling Stone to all the clubs. And we got a couple of residences going, which was Ken Collier's club in Leicester Square, and the other one was the Richmond Club. And very soon, I mean, within very short time, they were full up. And don't ask, ever since I've been with the Rolling, this has nothing to do with me, by the way, but ever since I've been with the Rolling Stones, people have come to look at us, to look at Keith and Brian and Mick, you know. Really, we've always had a following. It's been quite incredible in that way.
What do you think that is?
Well, I think visually, even those days, you know, the stage was about 4 foot by 5, and Mick would still do the same thing as he did does on a big stage.
Oh, yeah. Thank you kindly. I think I busted a button on my trousers. Hope they don't fall down. You don't want my trousers to fall down now, do you?
And at Richmond, we used to do incredible things on the tiniest stage of all. And he just had a way, you know, he's always had a way of putting it across. And I don't know. The three of them, I suppose. Brian had his funny sort of quirky way of doing it. And Mick was obviously on his way to being one of the great onstage people, of which I think he's the best in the world. Now Michael Jackson's gone. But he was, when they were alive, on a par with James Brown and Michael Jackson, as far as holding an audience and doing the right things on stage, really. If we do another one, he'll do it again, you know. I mean, he's the best, really.
Charlie's good tonight, isn't he?
I don't know where we go from there. Where do you want to go from there?
And I tried
I was going to talk about 1965 Satisfaction, first massive number one in both America and Britain. It must have been for you to go over to the States and start seeing some of the artists that you loved over in America. Must have been a big thrill.
I'm not sure if we went there. We hadn't done Satisfaction when we first went there, had we? So I got to New York and went to Birdland, which is a famous club. It closed down soon after I got there, not because of me, but because and a new one is now there, but the old one, the original one, I went to see that, and I went to various jazz clubs with Ian Stewart, and quite honestly, I'd seen America. For me, that was it.
It's done.
Yes. And then, of course, I went to Chicago, and we saw, the Chess and these various places that you long to see via records. But for me, it was New York. I saw two artists, Birdland. One was a 13-piece band, which was pretty amazing, with Charlie Mingus's band. And the other band was another guy I got to meet later in life, who is still the most... He's probably the greatest improviser in the world at the moment, is Sonny Rollins.
Thank you.
That was Sonny Rollins, one of the most influential jazz saxophonists of all time, with Someone to Watch Over Me, the George Gershwin standard. The choice here of my guest on the first time, Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts.
Six Music. BBC Six Music.
That was All Down the Line by the Rolling Stones, a cut from their 1972 classic album, Exile on Main Street. I'm Matt Everett, this is Six Music, and this is the first time with my guest, Rolling Stone drummer Charlie Watts. Around the time of recording the Exile album, the Stones were known for spending increasingly long hours in the studio, not perfecting details, just playing and playing all through the night till the atmosphere and the performance was just perfect. I asked Charlie if that was something that became difficult to deal with.
There's reason for a lot of these things. The Andrew Oldham, very cleverly actually, and thank goodness he did, I'm sure Mick, he's kind of coerced at the first thing, I think. Well, yeah, he did. Mick and Keith to write B-sides or songs for artists Andrew had, as well as us. When they were good enough, they were for us. They so happened to be good enough, so they were for us as well, songs. So there was that. There was the songwriting, which is, takes longer, and you know. And then don't forget that we, because the first albums were done in an afternoon, no mucking about, all finished, done, finished, signed, sealed, delivered. When we earned money, it was realised you could work in a studio forever. And subsequently, Keith particularly, even now, writes songs in the studio. That means to say he usually has germs of ideas, but he actually writes them in a studio or uses a studio as his workshop. And at that time, we were young and drinking and various other things, so time didn't really become of importance. So a day became a week. So for us to be in a studio for a month was nothing in those days, mainly because the recording costs were covered, you know. And in those days, in the late 60s, and through the 70s, records made so much. You sold so many records, and you made so much money off them, the record company, that they could afford you to be in there for whatever. Found out later, of course, it came off your end of the thing, but it was still an awful lot of money. You know, you're talking about a lot of record sales. It was the era of albums and singles selling, you know. I mean, our first albums, you know, used to have three singles off an album and the album all done in a year.
Now it takes
and ages. That went on, you know. The Beatles it was the norm. That's what they did. We used to have to time singles so that they didn't coincide with theirs, vice versa, and you'd all have an album out during that. You'd record it and have it out that year, you know. It was along with playing every day, which helped make the records as well. So, you know, it was a very, you were working. That's what I never understood with a lot of bands subsequently, you know, like Amy, for example, bless her, you know, she does works all these years. Oasis were another one. They worked all those years, become incredibly popular, i.e. like the Beatles were, nothing for about 3 years or something. And you just think, where's the, you know, the Beatles would have had three singles pulled off the album. Actually, we used to make singles besides the albums. So you used to save the best song for the single, or what you thought, and then, you know, and Amy didn't do another album after that wonderful one she did with Ronson.
There seemed to be, legend seems to have this image of it being such a debauched time, such a crazy time. You always seemed quite separate from that.
I've always been separate from rock and roll. It's never been what I... having said that, it doesn't mean to say I wasn't debauched and whatever, but it's never been a world, even now, I associate with, particularly.
What do you think that is, then?
Don't know. It's never interested me, rock and roll and groupies and all that. It's never been something... I've always found Duke Ellington in his orchestra much more attractive than 90% of the white groups that were very fashionable at the time I was playing. I was a white group myself. I don't know why. I was never brought up on rock and roll. Keith taught me to play me Elvis. I hated Elvis when I was at the age when everyone thought he was the most wonderful thing in the world. I would never wanted to look like that, and I wanted to be a black man in a club in New York. Don't ask me why. Thank you.
With the Stones, there was this incredible run of records, Sticky Fingers, Exile, where kind of the band seemed to be just producing some astonishing work.
A lot of that is to do with the songs. For me, that period with Mick Taylor at that age is probably the peak of the Rolling Stones band. It was live as well. Mick brought a quality to the Rolling Stones that they've never had before or since. I don't know why, don't know how. You know, bands are a weird thing. They're a mixture of things. Ronnie brings another thing, but Mick Taylor brought a thing to... I think he kind of prefers playing with Ronnie in that guitar way, you know, when they weave and that. But as an era, as a band, the songs... Well, you know, I just think the song, they help you do play a lot. I got no idea. It might have been my age, you know. I got no idea. You know, having said all that about rock and roll, there are certain people, and particularly players that I've met and love that play what we call rock and roll.
Okay.
Well, I think Jimmy Page is one of the great. I think Led Zeppelin were a bloody good band. The Who were a fantastic band, if that's rock and roll. That, to me, is not... I mean, it's rock and roll. It's not Chuck Berry. Rock and roll, if you know what I mean. You know, and of course, I've been fortunate enough to meet people like... And call him a friend, actually, Earl Palmer, you know, who played. But Earl was a jazz drummer. If you saw Earl play and what he played, he was a New Orleans jazz drummer that happened to play on a lot of... So kind of like me, in a way, you know, happens to play on a lot of rock and roll. Hal Blaine was an out-and-out... Hal Blaine was like a Ringo, in a way. Hal Blaine played songs fantastically well.
The phrasing in the way...
Wonderful. And, I mean, blimey, the list of... But I never wanted to play like Hal Blaine. I wanted to play like Shelly Manne. You know, there's a sort of difference. What that is, I don't know, but there is a kind of difference... But Shelly Manne was my man. But Hal Blaine, as a player of songs, is like Ringo. You know, Ringo plays songs great. You couldn't play Walrus and all them things without Ringo. I mean, that's how you play him. Whether John stood over him or you know, Paul going da-da-da-da-da. I don't know. I wasn't there. But the way he plays them, they're wonderful.
Sitting on a cornflake, waiting for the van to come.
You mentioned that you've always maintained a kind of distance from the kind of narcotic overindulgence of the band, but you did have an issue in the 80s, didn't you? You did kind of have your own battles with sort of drug addiction.
Yeah, and drink. I didn't really have a... I was lucky that I never got that hooked on it that bad, but I did have a... Yes. I went through a period of taking heroin.
When did you realise it was a problem and how did you get off?
I used to get off it whenever I went home. I think when my marriage started to go a bit wobbly and my wife noticed I wasn't the same. And Keith, I fell asleep on the floor during maybe some girls or something and he woke me up and said, you should do this when you're older. Keith telling me this. And it stuck and and I just stopped along with everything else.
I want to talk as well, if you don't mind talking about it. In 2004, you were diagnosed with throat cancer.
Yeah. Well, I had two operations.
Yeah.
And radiotherapy, which is the way they do it. I found all this out, having gone through it.
How did you react when you first found out?
I thought I was going to die.
Do you think that was it?
I had a lump on my throat, which I'd had for a couple of years. And I went to see actually Mick's throat guy, and I didn't know that at the time, but it was Mick. I went to see the best man in the world, Peter Rhys Evans, who's a surgeon and throat man, and they looked all the thing, and it was benign, this lump, but we should take it out. They took it out, looked on the slide, and it had tiny cancerous cells in it. So I'd already had an operation, which I hate hospitals. I've never been in one before. So I'd done that, and I went along to tell me, you know, how does it look and all that. And that night I thought I was going to die. Well, I just thought that's what you did if you got cancer. You'd curl up and you waste away and die. And I went back for all the other stuff, and then another operation to take the lymph nodes and all that out. And then every week, every month, every year, and now it's 5 years, it's cleared. And they have a huge success rate at the Royal Marsden, and I cannot say enough for Peter Rhys Evans, the doctors and the nurses there. They're amazing people.
How come the Stones are still together?
Got no idea.
Is it bloody-mindedness? Is it the music? Is it nobody wants to be the one to quit? What is it?
I think it's about two of those at least. Well, three of them. I think no one wants to quit because the other one will say, you quit.
Somebody once said that the secret to a good marriage is just not getting divorced. Is that what it's like? Just sticking with it?
It's been a bit like that in the past. We are getting to an age where it's going to be very difficult. You know, it will be lovely next year to do some shows because it'll be 50 years. You know, as I said, Ronnie plays, I still play. Mick sings, you know, he can do it anyway. I think Keith's doing some records and that, you know, whatever. But anyway, it'd be great if we did. We're just getting to an age where it's getting a bit difficult to get it together. And it's such a bloody performance getting us all together. And it's incredibly expensive. If you do all these things.
The final track at the end of the show, we'll play a song. You get to choose it. What should we finish the show
on? What song?
It could be anything you want. Something of yours, something from someone you love. Simple as that.
I can't think. Just Friends, Charlie Parker, with strings.
Then that's the song we should finish on. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
We'll be right back. This is BBC Radio
6 Music.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.